Episode 235, Chapter 14 of Dracula. Welcome to Craftlit, the podcast for crafters who love books. My name is Heather Ordover, and I'm podcasting from the shores of the Potomac in Virginia, the Old Dominion. Episode 235, Sometimes a Cigar is Just... This episode of Craftlit is brought to you by Knit Circus, the online magazine featuring three rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can find out more by visiting www.knitcircus.com. Also, Cool for Cats, the new novel by Andrew C. Ordover. You can get it at amazon.com or find out more from the link in the show notes. And the big happy news I've been waiting to share with you. This week's show is brought to you by Audible. Please visit audiblepodcast.com/craftlit for your free audiobook download. So first today, I did want to remind you of our December incentives. Julie Tomaseva in the UK has graciously offered to put up two gorgeous patterns, a hat and mitten set. You can see pictures of them on the show notes at craftlit.com. If you donate to Craftlit during the month of December, and let me know your address if you would like to have a What Would Madame Defarge Knit bracelet sent to you, please do that. There is a button on the craftlit.com website that will take you to PayPal to make it all easy and reasonably painless for you and put you into the drawing for the knitting patterns. So hi! What's been happening out here in Craftlit land, you ask? Lots of different things. However, I am trying desperately to get all of the podcasts recorded so that they will load while I'm gone, so that you won't miss any chapters of Dracula. And why am I doing this? Because I couldn't stand having to wait 3 or 4 weeks to hear the next few chapters, especially after you listen to the one today. And I just don't feel that it's fair for me to torture you in a way that I wouldn't want to be tortured myself. Somehow that just seems wrong. So I am going to be able to make some announcements and share some stuff with you today, and then not in the next few podcasts, which I think I mentioned last time. But I also wanted to apologize. Anybody who wrote to me in the last week since the last podcast went out, my computer started freaking out. I'm sure it was because I upgraded to the newest operating system, and it was very glitchy and very slow, and the cloud was really weird, and I was getting frustrated. And I dropped an iPad and cracked the screen. It was really just a bad week for computer products. I wound up spending an inordinate amount of the time on the phone with the support people and had to do a complete reinstall where they actually took control of my computer and did the reinstallation remotely for me. So in the middle of all of that, my mailbox had to get rebuilt like 4 or 5 times. And emails that had come in that I hadn't read got marked as read. So I may have completely missed emails from you. So don't feel like I'm ignoring you. If you have not heard back from me, or if you have not gotten your bracelet, drop me a line. You can write to heather@craftlit.com, and I will get right back to you as fast as I can with enormous apologies. I love technology when it works. And then there's the rest of the time. So before the computer took a nosedive, I was able to get onto Skype and talk with Stephanie Talent. Now, Stephanie is a designer that you may or may not know yet, but you will know her soon. She has a book coming out soon called California Revival Knitting. It is a style that is near and dear to my heart because it goes back to old school California, the kind of California that existed when I was born and has now pretty much been paved over. But it's a very interesting design style that, well, here, I'll let Stephanie explain it to you.
Basically, if you were to go up to Hearst Castle or something like that, or go over to Catalina and see all, you know, the casino or some of the older buildings, or even just go around through some of the older neighborhoods and the little Spanish bungalows, it's a co-opted style based originally on combination of like the mission style or the actual missions that were built here. And it has a variety of influences from Spanish to Mexican to the Moroccan, and it's kind of like California, a mishmash of things. So,
very. And
it's just an architectural style I really like. And our own little house that we have, it's a 900 square foot little bungalow, and it just appeals to me. So,
there's a lot of, as I recall from when I lived there, there was a lot of, it always reminded me a little bit of like the mission style and Frank Lloyd Wright always kind of blended in my mind. And I know there's the pattern, a pattern that you did. It's the one that's kind of a rust colored. There's the sweater that you wore in Rhinebeck.
Right.
Aren't
right,
there like matching, right, matching fingerless mitts that go with that?
There's coordinated fingerless mittens, right?
Okay.
Right, and those were more inspired just by the wrought iron work that you see in whether it's gates or window grills or what have you.
Right.
So that's pretty ubiquitous here with the style.
Now, do you really have to go to a certain part of California to see this kind of style, or is it still scattered all over?
No, it's all over the place. It's all over the place. And honestly, you don't even have to be in California to see it. Whether or not it's going to be held California Revival Style or Mission Revival or Mission or anything, you can go to Florida. In the late 1920s, 1930s, if you look at kind of, and I'm not an expert on this, but if you have around the turn of the century, you have all the Victorian stuff. And then you have the Arts and Crafts Movement, which was a backlash against manufactured fruit type of stuff. And that's when you're getting, typical craftsman bungalows, lots of woodwork, darker. And then after that, people kind of segued more into a lot of more fanciful inspirations. So you would see like Tudor styles, like little Tudor style bungalows. Or if you go to Carmel, you can see a lot of like the little storybook cottages and things like that. And those were all the late teens through the 1920s sort of thing. So and then as you progress, you're getting more of the Art Deco stuff and then some of the like the streamlined modern type of stuff. But the California, like the revival style or whatever you want to, think of it like the red tile style, but it's kind of one of the things where in and of itself, I don't think it's a superficial thing because I think if you look back and look at the quality of the construction, even in like little kit houses and just the little details, you don't get those in houses today.
No.
But it was a fanciful take. It wasn't, it's like if somebody built a castle today, but they put all their, all the luxuries of home into it, as opposed to what a real, like living in a real castle would be like.
Right.
Kind of the same take. It was like, okay, we're going to evoke the style, or whether it's Tudor or Mission, or, sometimes you'll get like the Pueblo type of style, with the beams and everything that looks like a, southwestern,
right,
New Mexico type of style. And all kind of in the same time period.
That's very interesting. So, I lived in two craftsman cottages in my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
and they always had built-ins. They always felt
right.
solid. They survived every earthquake.
Right.
And they just, it was like there was the form follows function. Everything was very functional
right.
and useful, but it was all very beautiful.
Beautiful, yeah. And that's like the William Morris quote, have nothing in your house that's not beautiful or serves a purpose. I know, forgive me, I just butchered that. But
so let's talk about your knitting. Because here you are, you've burst onto the scene, you have this gorgeous book, and the book is gorgeous. And when is the book coming out?
It should be out. We're hoping to get everything turned in by around Christmas time, and then hopefully mid-January, I'm hoping we'll be getting the hard copies done. But Shannon keeps telling me not to promise anybody that, but that's what we're still shooting for.
All right, so we're not promising anything for Christmas.
No, it's if anything, the PDF maybe, but it's still in tech editing, and for your listeners and stuff, tech editors are when you find a good one, they're they're usually like totally overworked. And so I know that the tech editor who's working on it is really swamped with stuff. So
And I know Shannon's tech editors are unbelievable. Yeah. I mean, so far we have found in Defarge there's been one line that got removed accidentally. And that's it.
Which is incredible.
Which is incredible.
Errata is normally published.
So we've got a mid-January release, we hope, of the actual print copy and maybe an earlier release of the PDFs. And what is it that got you started designing in the first place? Because in your day job, you're a veterinarian.
Right, a small animal veterinarian. Well, what I do as a veterinarian is what's called milk and tenons or relief work. I fill in at clinics as needed. And honestly, with up to a couple years ago, if I wanted to work 7 days a week, 365 days a year, I could have. But, you know, with the economy, it's hit everybody, and it's hit pet owners, and people just aren't bringing their pets in. I mean, I tell people this, and they look at me and like, how can people not bring their pets in? But they can't, you know, they can't. And speaking of pets, you probably hear Rachel barking in the background. But anyway, so pet owner visits dropped out. I mean, clinics can't. I mean, they've been laying off associates. They've been laying off veterinarians and staff. So my work, you know, just as a kind of like substitute teacher of veterinarians, has dropped off quite a bit.
Wow.
And I had more time for knitting. And I decided a couple of years ago I was going to knit everybody small presents, just like mittens or hats or whatever for Christmas. But I ended up, I think, with like 30-odd things I was going to knit. And there's wonderful patterns out there, but I was getting kind of picky, and I was like tweaking things and changing things, and I was like, I can start doing this myself, I can start designing. And that's kind of where it took off. And then I'm pretty much a type A personality, so when I wasn't spending as much time working at clinics, I had to do something that would really keep me engaged and busy, and I just threw myself into designing, into learning different software for pattern presentation and all sorts of stuff. So that's kind of how that happened.
But that's, you know, it's kind of nice, because if work is going to drop off, it's really nice that you had something else that you went, well, you know, here I can turn my focus to this.
I can really make a positive thing out of it. And I love doing it. I mean, I love designing. I can't picture not designing. And, I mean, in an ideal world, I do 2 or 3 days a week that stuff, and the rest of the time, you know, designing stuff.
So one of the things that it says on your signature line on your email is that you work with Knit Circus. So what do you do?
Knit Circus, it's a funny way how I got involved with that, because it was the first year that I was designing, and they had a designer basically flake and not, I mean, they were looking for like a sweater or a vest, and the designer that they had set up basically flaked and didn't get anything done or anything turned in. And so they were looking for anybody who could design anything just last minute and get it knit up and get it turned in so they could have, you know, the piece for the magazine. And I was like, I'll do this. I was like, yeah, I mean, it's kind of like my tendency to take on more than I have to, but I was like, oh, I'll do this. And I did a really cute little Aran vest, cabled vest, with some Blackwater Abbey yarn, and the yarn support came through. I mean, Marilyn was great getting yarn support at the last minute, and everything all worked out. And Jala at Knit Circus really loved the design, and kind of from there, I kept on doing more designs for them, and then I've also started tech editing myself, and I tech edit for them now, so...
Which is a gift, being able to tech edit, seriously?
I can't tech edit my own stuff.
Yeah. It took me a long time to convince students, even at college students, that you can't, you think you can, but you can't edit your own work, because your brain is not stupid. Your brain thinks it wrote what it meant to write, and it's going to see that. And it's just, it's not fair to ask your brain to try and do that, because it's impossible.
Right. I cringe when I see people who say, oh, well, it's just an easy pattern, so I don't need a tech editor. Oh. It's like, oh, my God, yes, you do still, you know. Just even if it's going to be a quick tech edit, just have another set of eyes on it and looking at the numbers, you know. So
absolutely.
I do have another book that I'm working on, another themed pattern book with a mix of patterns and stuff, and I'm hoping to include maybe a little bit more background info in that one. The California Revival Knits has some background info, but it's a book on knitting patterns inspired. It's not a book about the California Revival. So,
right.
So anyway, the fifth one I'm hoping to include maybe a little bit more literary tie-ins or place in flora and fauna and sort of things.
Literary tie-ins? What a unique, interesting idea.
I know.
We've started a trend.
I'm going to try with the California Revival Knits book. I ended up putting such a short deadline on myself that I wasn't able to do anything else at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And with this one, I'm going to try to give myself a little bit more time with it so I can have, you know, one-off patterns or whatever at the same, you know, same time.
Right.
Just so I'm not disappearing from the design world for another year or whatever.
So understand. So are you planning, have you already planned times or dates for knit-alongs, trunk shows? Are you going to be at any of the sheep and wool things? Like, we met at Rhinebeck. Do you have anything set up that you want to make sure people know about in advance?
Right now, what I'm looking at, I'm going to be at Madrona, and we may be doing something with the book for that. I'm not sure on that. And I'm hoping to be teaching just a mini class there. More like on people creating their own, maybe designers doing their own style sheets. It's something that there's actually for knit circus, we came up with a really good style guide that I recommend people looking at if they don't know where to start. So anyway, the little class that I put together is more just kind of to get people to see what things should be included, what things they should be considering, and guiding them in what they should be looking at when they are working on creating their own document to help them with self-publishing.
What a great idea.
So I think as a tech editor, I've had seen a lot of patterns. It's something that I think there's a need for. So
definitely.
Yeah, so there, and then the next weekend after that, so that's all in February. The next weekend after that is Stitches West. And I'm planning on doing a book signing at the Bijou Basin booth.
Yay!
I love Carl. Carl is so great. He's so funny. But yeah, they're great people. So
I really like them a lot. And the first time I ever met them was up at Rhinebeck. And
So the yarn's beautiful. So
yes.
And they did yarn support for one of the towels in the book. So So probably going out for Stitches Midwest and then for Vogue in Chicago.
Wow, you're going to be all over the place.
Yeah, you know, it's weird. I mean, this is the first year that I've really been trying to go to a lot of these places, and it's really fun to be able to meet people that you've just otherwise known on email or whatever. And it's also fun because I'm meeting new people who have actually heard of my designs before. I mean, that was probably one of the most exciting things when I was at Talk Summit, and I met people who I hadn't met before, and they were like, oh, I love your designs, you know, and I was like, wow. It's still very novel and exciting to me when I hear that, so I am enjoying that a lot.
Yeah. Well, this is great. Yay!
Hey, thank you.
So that was the sweet and marvelous Stephanie Talent, who is very talented. I didn't make that joke until she was off the phone, but her book really is beautiful. And as soon as it comes out, I will make sure to put a link in the show notes so that you can get to it from craftlit.com. All right, so new knitting book coming out. Very exciting stuff. And Stephanie is one of the people who, up at Rhinebeck, we really felt like we were all putting the cooperative in cooperative press, because there we were, a bunch of different authors all working together and helping sell each other's books and chatting up each other's stuff. And it felt like a family. I don't mean to be all syrupy and stuff, but it really, really was nice to be able to work with this marvelous group of women. It was just... There are days when I just feel so lucky. You know, I have you, I have them, I have my family. This is good. And other good things are things like Dracula. Yes, yes, here we are in Dracula land. And oh my goodness, if it doesn't start moving along now. I actually had to write down pages of notes because so much is starting to happen. You know, we've gotten through the exposition and putting the chess pieces in their places, and now you're really starting to watch the chess game actually start to take place. And it's interesting that I've been using that metaphor for hundreds of years now, because this book actually is a chess game. You know, it's for the good guys, it's all about getting Dracula, the king, and capturing him and getting rid of him, deposing him, as it were. And it is very much a chessboard with some characters who can move in certain ways and do certain things, and others who work in other ways and do other things. And it's a chess game. And we are now fully engaged. In fact, I got a couple of emails this week that I actually today, they both came in today, which is why I have them. Aha. They both came in today. And the first one I'll just read you a little piece of is from Aaron Ziegler. He and his producer and partner in crime, Shannon, were listening to Chapter 13, and he agreed with my take on Seward, which is a big, huge sigh of relief to me. You know, you don't want to insult the guy who's reading the part for your podcast for free and all. That would be really, really rude. But he did say that he thinks that Seward's scientific mind gets in the way. His belief that the world should be an ordered place may cause him to overlook some of the truth of what's happening. And he also makes a point that it was kind of floating around in my brain too, but he put it really nicely, that Seward in some ways is the character who the scientific rational Victorian community would have identified with most clearly. The skeptic, the scientific mind, the one who's like, no, I don't think that's what's going on, really. And of course, again, thinking about being a reading public that hadn't heard any vampire stories before, it would be very easy to be Seward and to deny what to us looks like the obvious. And that's a way to, as Aaron Ziegler put it, lure the audience into this otherwise unbelievable scenario. And he said, by Seward doubting and fumbling around, we are unknowingly objecting to what would have been our own reactions had we never heard of vampires or faced them in quote unquote real life. And I think that that is a really, really good point to keep in mind, because I guarantee you, you're going to want to throw Seward through a window at some point in the next three chapters, because you're just going to go, just accept the fact that it's a vampire. But it's good to keep in mind what Stoker was working on. And then the other email came in from our friend, Marcelli Botticelli, who continues to have all of her blood inside her body instead of draining away. She wrote in and said, well, first she complimented Aaron Ziegler, so Aaron, nice work. But the other thing she wrote was, one thing I kept thinking from the last episode is why Dracula seems to have this preference for feeding on beautiful women. We know based on Jonathan's accounts that the three women back home were gorgeous, and then you got Lucy, and then they see him following another beautiful creature, that would be Jonathan and Mina, see him looking at another beautiful creature like a vulture would a carcass. Nice job, Marcelli. I don't think by any stretch of the imagination that he's capable of love. There's also no indication that he has sexual intercourse as we know it with his victims. So why the preference? One would think that if he was feeding just for survival purposes, he would pick the largest men he could find. I kept trying to remember from my past readings of this book to see if I could find an explanation on that, but all that comes to mind is that he is a calculating beast with very good survival skills. Am I missing something? And I think Marcelli brings up a really, really interesting question, and one that I think lends itself to people who see this as just, you know, an enormous sexual allegory. But I think he's Well, he's an opportunistic feeder, because as far as we know, he did feed on men on the boat coming over. And we really aren't sure what he fed on. That is so disgusting to say. We aren't sure what he fed on when he was in Transylvania. He was bringing the small children back in the bag for the three voluptuous women. But I don't think at this point in the story we can come to any conclusions about that. There is, however, one interesting point that Marcelli alluded to, and that only occurred to me listening to this particular chapter we're about to hit for the 17th time, which is that Lucy may have gotten the blood of four nice, strong, strapping men put into her to try and keep her alive, but Dracula was the actual beneficiary of all of their blood. Now, Jonathan kind of freaks out when he sees Dracula again in the street because he has grown young. Well, we saw him old in Transylvania. Perhaps what he was feeding on in Transylvania was not so healthy. Perhaps after a boat ride over, feasting on an entire ship full of strapping sailors, and then getting the blood of Lucy and the four men into him, maybe that's why he's young. It's the, ever since the TV show Lost was out, people have started speaking about storytelling this way, that the mythology that has been created for this book by Bram Stoker is actually rather curious. We are used to some very simple pat answers. If there is a villain, it's because he had a bad childhood. There are always some kind of explanation. There's always some kind of explanation that's prepared for us and given to us so that we don't have any uncomfortable loose ends left. But Bram Stoker was not writing at a time when that was necessarily the most important part of telling a suspenseful story. And I mean, even, what is it, in The Big Sleep? Even Raymond Chandler didn't know who killed the chauffeur. I think the story is that while they were working on the movie, Bogart or someone, a grip or a cameraman, came over and Raymond Chandler was on the set and said, "Hey, I don't remember reading this in the script. Who killed the chauffeur?" And Raymond Chandler went, "Oh my gosh, I have no idea." I don't know if the story is apocryphal or not, but it makes a lot of sense when you have something as complicated as The Big Sleep, or in our case, Dracula. It makes a lot of sense to me that creating the mythology, that would be the rules that govern how Dracula is able to behave, are fairly complicated. And speaking to that point, you will hear Van Helsing say some unbelievably cryptic things over the next few chapters. And I finally got to the point where I started to treat it like Shakespeare. And I just go, okay, so that's a rule. I'm just going to file that away in the back of my mind as Van Helsing said a rule. But I don't feel that the suspense of the novel itself is quite so dependent on Van Helsing's statements of the rules. It's not as much of a key part as Edward sparkling in the sunlight is a key part of, what is it, the second Twilight book. That in that case, the rule really does create the suspense. And I think here, honestly, the randomness and the way that Stoker is able to tap into fear of chaos and anarchy. Here's in a very mannered, organized society, here is a guy who is not playing by our rules. It almost doesn't matter what his rules are. It's that he's not playing by our rules. It's not fair to go in and drink all of Lucy's blood. And I think that's where our horror comes from. All right, enough about that. A couple of terms that I wanted to share with you. You will hear Mina say à demain. It sounds like she says à demain, but it's à deux, two, main, hands. So it's taking something into both hands. That's one term that you may not be familiar with. Another one is cicatrized. It's spelled cicatrised, and it means that a scar has formed. So that you will hear from Seward. And then the only other thing I wanted to let you know is Stoker has really spread the narrative out across a large swath of countryside. I mean, from Transylvania to begin with, And then you have part of the story happening in London, part happening in Whitby, which is, you know, 5.5 hours to the north, I think. And then the other part in Exeter, which is like on your way to Cornwall. So people are spread out. And at first I thought, well, that's kind of curious. But then I thought, well, no, maybe what he's trying to do is bring everyone in the country in so that there's some piece of the story that actively happens in or fits in their world, thus making it scarier. Because if you lived outside of London and read the book, it would be, well, if it all took place in London, you could write it off and say, well, vampires only happen in London, thank God, not here. But I think Stoker may have been trying to go for a little more fear than that. And so on that note, I will start you on chapter 14 of Dracula. We begin with Mina Harker's journal.
23rd September. Jonathan is better after a bad night. I am so glad that he has plenty of work to do, for that keeps his mind off the terrible things. And oh, I am rejoiced that he is not now weighed down with the responsibility of his new position. I knew he would be true to himself, and now how proud I am to see my Jonathan rising to the height of his advancement, and keeping pace in all ways with the duties that come upon him. He will be away all day till late, for he said he could not lunch at home. My household work is done, so I shall take his foreign journal, and lock myself up in my room and read it. 24th September. I hadn't the heart to write last night. That terrible record of Jonathan's upset me so. Poor dear! How he must have suffered, whether it be true or only imagination. I wonder if there is any truth in it at all. Did he get his brain fever and then write all those terrible things, or had he some cause for it all? I suppose I shall never know, for I dare not open the subject to him. And yet that man we saw yesterday, he seemed quite certain of him, poor fellow. I suppose it was the funeral upset him and sent his mind back on some train of thought. He believes it all himself. I remember how on our wedding day he said, "Unless some solemn duty come upon me to go back to the bitter hours, asleep or awake, mad or sane." There seems to be through it all some thread of continuity. That fearful count was coming to London. If it should be, and he came to London, with its teeming millions, there may be a solemn duty, and if it come we must not shrink from it. I shall be prepared. I shall get my typewriter this very hour and begin transcribing. Then we shall be ready for other eyes, if required. And if it be wanted, then perhaps, if I am ready, poor Jonathan may not be upset, for I can speak for him, and never let him be troubled or worried with it all. If ever Jonathan quite gets over the nervousness, he may want to tell me of it all, and I can ask him questions and find out things, and see how I may comfort him.
Letter van Helsing to Miss Harker, September 24th. Confidence. Dear Madam, I pray you to pardon my writing, and that I am so far friend as that I sent you sad news of Miss Lucy Westonroth's death. By the kindness of Lord Godalming, I am empowered to read her letters and papers, for I am deeply concerned about certain matters vitally important. In them I find some letters from you, which show how great friends you were and how you love her. O Madam Mina, by that love, I implore you, help me. It is for others' good that I ask, to redress great wrong and to lift much and terrible troubles that may be more great than you can know. May it be that I see you? You can trust me. I am friend of Dr. John Seward and of Lord Godalming, that was Arthur of Miss Lucy. I must keep it private for the present from all. I should come to Exeter to see you at once if you tell me I am privileged to come, and where and when. I implore your pardon, madam. I have read your letters to poor Lucy, and I know how good you are and how your husband suffer. So I pray you, if it may be, enlighten him not, lest it may harm. Again your pardon and forgive me, Van Helsing.
Telegram from Mrs. Harker to Van Helsing.
25th September. Come today by 10:15 train if you can catch it. Can see you any time you call. Wilhelmina Harker.
Mina Harker's journal.
25th September. I cannot help feeling terribly excited as the time draws near for the visit of Dr. Van Helsing, for somehow I expect that it will throw some light upon Jonathan's sad experience, and as he attended poor dear Lucy in her last illness, he can tell me all about her. That is the reason of his coming. It is concerning Lucy and her sleepwalking, and not about Jonathan. Then I shall never know the real truth now. How silly I am. That awful journal gets hold of my imagination and tinges everything with something of its own colour. Of course it is about Lucy. That habit came back to the poor dear, and that awful night on the cliff must have made her ill. I had almost forgotten in my own affairs how ill she was afterwards. She must have told him of her sleepwalking adventure on the cliff, and that I knew all about it, and now he wants me to tell him what I know, so that he may understand. I hope I did right in not saying anything of it to Mrs. Westenra. I should never forgive myself if any act of mine, were it even a negative one, brought harm on poor dear Lucy. I hope, too, Dr. Van Helsing will not blame me. I have had so much trouble and anxiety of late that I feel I cannot bear more just at present. I suppose a cry does us all good at times, clears the air as other rain does. Perhaps it was reading the journal yesterday that upset me, and then Jonathan went away this morning to stay away from me a whole day and night, the first time we have been parted since our marriage. I do hope the dear fellow will take care of himself, and that nothing will occur to upset him. It is 2 o'clock, and the doctor will be here soon now. I shall say nothing of Jonathan's journal unless he asks me. I am so glad I have typewritten out my own journal, so that in case he asks about Lucy, I can hand it to him. It will save much questioning. Later. He has come and gone. Oh, what a strange meeting, and how it all makes my head whirl round. I feel like one in a dream. Can it be all possible, or even a part of it? If I had not read Jonathan's journal first, I should never have accepted even such a possibility. Oh, poor, poor, dear Jonathan! How he must have suffered! Please the good God all this may not upset him again. I shall try to save him from it. But it may be even a consolation and a help to him, terrible though it be and awful in its consequences, to know for certain that his eyes and ears and brain did not deceive him, and that it is all true. It may be that it is the doubt which haunts him, that when the doubt is removed, no matter which, waking or dreaming may prove the truth, he will be more satisfied and better able to bear the shock. Dr. Van Helsing must be a good man as well as a clever one, if he is Arthur's friend and Dr. Seward's, and if they brought him all the way from Holland to look after Lucy. I feel from having seen him that he is good and kind and of a noble nature. When he comes tomorrow, I shall ask him about Jonathan. And then, please God, all this sorrow and anxiety may lead to a good end. I used to think I would like to practice interviewing. Jonathan's friend on the Exeter News told him that memory is everything in such work, that you must be able to put down exactly almost every word spoken, even if you had to refine some of it afterwards. Here was a rare interview. I shall try to record it verbatim. It was 2:30 when the knock came. I took my courage à deux mains and waited. In a few minutes Mary opened the door and announced Dr. Van Helsing. I rose and bowed, and he came towards me, a man of medium weight, strongly built, with his shoulders set back over a broad, deep chest, and a neck well balanced on the trunk as the head is on the neck. The poise of the head strikes me at once as indicative of thought and power. The head is noble, well-sized, broad, and large behind the ears. The face, clean-shaven, shows a hard, square chin, a large, resolute, mobile mouth, a good-sized nose, rather straight, but with quick, sensitive nostrils, that seem to broaden as the big, bushy brows come down and the mouth tightens. The forehead is broad and fine, rising at first almost straight, and then sloping back above 2 bumps or ridges wide apart, such a forehead that the reddish hair cannot possibly tumble over it, but falls naturally back and to the sides. Big, dark blue eyes are set widely apart, and are quick and tender or stern with the man's moods. He said to me, "Mrs. Harker, is it not?" I bowed assent. "That was Miss Mina Murray?" Again I assented. "It is Miss Mina Murray that I came to see that was a friend of that poor dear child Lucy Westenra. Madame Mina, it is on account of the dead that I come." "Sir," said I, "you could have no better claim on me than that you were a friend and helper of Lucy Westenra." And I held out my hand. He took it and said tenderly, "Oh, Madame Mina, I know that the friend of that poor little girl must be good, but I had yet to learn." He finished his speech with a courtly bow. I asked him what it was that he wanted to see me about, so he at once began. "I have read your letters to Miss Lucy. Forgive me, but I had to begin to inquire somewhere, and there was none to ask. I know that you were with her at Whitby. She sometimes kept a diary. You need not look surprised, Madam Mina. It was begun after you had left, and was an imitation of you. And in that diary she traces by inference certain things to a sleepwalking in which she puts down that you saved her. In great perplexity, then, I come to you, and ask you, out of your so much kindness, to tell me all of it that you can remember.
I can tell you, I think, Dr. Van Helsing, all about it.
Ah, then you have good memory for facts, for details. It is not always so with young ladies.
No, Doctor, but I wrote it all down at the time. I can show it to you if you like.
Oh, Madam Mina, I well be grateful. You will do me much favour.
I could not resist the temptation of mystifying him a bit. I suppose it is some taste of the original apple that remains still in our mouths. So I handed him the shorthand diary. He took it with a grateful bow and said,
"May I read it?"
"If you wish," I answered as demurely as I could. He opened it, and for an instant his face fell. Then he stood up and bowed.
"Oh, you so clever woman," he said. "I knew long that Mr. Jonathan was a man of much thankfulness, but see, his wife have all the good things. And will you not so much honour me and so help me as to read it for me? Alas, I know not the shorthand."
By this time my little joke was over, and I was almost ashamed. So I took the typewritten copy from my work-basket and handed it to him. "Forgive me," I said. "I could not help it, but I had been thinking that it was of dear Lucy that you wished to ask, and so that you might not have time to wait, not on my account, but because I know your time must be precious, I have written it out on the typewriter for you."
He took it, and his eyes glistened. "You are so good," he said. "And may I read it now? I may want to ask you some things when I have read."
"By all means," I said. "Read it over whilst I order lunch, and then you can ask me questions whilst we eat." He bowed and settled himself in a chair with his back to the light, and became so absorbed in the papers, whilst I went to see after lunch chiefly in order that he might not be disturbed. When I came back, I found him walking hurriedly up and down the room, his face all ablaze with excitement. He rushed up to me and took me by both hands.
"Oh, Madam Mina," he said, "how can I say what I owe to you? This paper is as sunshine. It opens the gate to me. I am dazed, I am dazzled with so much light. And yet clouds roll in behind the light every time. But that you do not, you cannot comprehend. Oh, but I am grateful to you, you so clever woman."
"Madame," he said this very solemnly,
"if ever Abraham Van Helsing can do anything for you or yours, I trust you will let me know. It will be pleasure and delight if I may serve you as a friend, as a friend. But all I have ever learned, all I can ever do, shall be for you and those you love. There are darknesses in life, and there are lights. You are one of the lights. You will live a happy life and a good life, and your husband will be blessed in you."
"But, Doctor, you praise me too much, and you do not know me."
"Not know you? I, who am old and who have studied all my life men and women, I who have made my specialty the brain and all that belongs to him, and all that follow from him? And I have read your diary that you have so goodly written for me, and which breathes out truth in every line. I, who have read your so sweet letter to poor Lucy of your marriage and your trust, not know you? Oh, Madam Mina, good women tell all their lives, and by day and by hour and by minute such things that angels can read. And we men who wish to know have in us something of angels' eyes. Your husband is noble nature, and you are noble too, for you trust, and trust cannot be where there is mean nature. And your husband, tell me of him. Is he quite well? Is all that fever gone, and is he strong and hearty?"
I saw here an opening to ask him about Jonathan, so I said, "He was almost recovered, but he has been greatly upset by Mr. Hawkins' death."
He interrupted, "Oh, yes, I know, I know. I have read your last two letters."
I went on, "I suppose this upset him, for when we were in town on Thursday last, he had a sort of shock."
"A shock? And after brain fever so soon? That is not good. What kind of shock was it?"
"He thought he saw someone who recalled something terrible, something which led to his brain fever." And here the whole thing seemed to overwhelm me in a rush. The pity for Jonathan, the horror which he experienced, the whole fearful mystery of his diary, and the fear that has been brooding over me all since, all came in a tumult. I suppose I was hysterical, for I threw myself on my knees and held up my hands to him, and implored him to make my husband well again. He took my hands and raised me up and made me sit on the sofa, and sat by me. He held my hand in his, and said to me with, oh, such infinite sweetness,
"My life is a barren and lonely one, and so full of work that I have not had much time for friendships. But since I have been summoned to hear by my friend John Seward,
I have known so many good people and seen such nobility that I feel more than ever, and it has grown with my advancing years, the loneliness of my life. Believe me, then, that I come here full of respect for you, and you have given me hope. Hope, not in what I am seeking of, but that there are good women still left to make life happy. Good women, whose lives and whose truths may make good lesson for the children that are to be. I am glad, glad that I may be here of some use to you. For if your husband suffer, he suffer within the range of my study and experience. I promise you that I will gladly do all for him that I can, all to make his life strong and manly, and your life a happy one. Now you must eat. You are overwrought and perhaps over-anxious. Husband Jonathan would not like to see you so pale, and what he like not where he love is not to his good. Therefore, for his sake, you must eat and smile. You have told me about Lucy, and so now we shall not speak of it, lest it distress. I shall stay in Exeter tonight, for I want to think much over what you have told me, and when I have thought I will ask you questions, if I may. And then, too, you will tell me of husband Jonathan's trouble so far as you can, but not yet. You must eat now. Afterwards you shall tell me all. After lunch, when we went back to the drawing-room, he said to me, "And now tell me all about him." When it came to speaking to this great learned man, I began to fear that he would think me a weak fool, and Jonathan a madman. That journal is all so strange, and I hesitated to go on. But he was so sweet and kind, and he had promised to help, and I trusted him. So I said, "Dr. Van Helsing, what I have to tell you is so queer that you must not laugh at me or at my husband. I have been since yesterday in a sort of fever of doubt. You must be kind to me, and not think me foolish that I have even half-believed some very strange things." He reassured me by his manner as well as his words when he said, "Oh, my dear, if you only know how strange is the matter regarding which I am here, it is you who would laugh. I have learned not to think little of any one's belief, no matter how strange it may be. I have tried to keep an open mind, and it is not the ordinary things of life that could close it, but the strange things, the extraordinary things, the things that make one doubt if they be mad or sane." "Oh, thank you. Thank you a thousand times. You have taken a weight off my mind. If you will let me, I shall give you a paper to read. It is long, but I have typewritten it out. It will tell you my trouble and Jonathan's. It is the copy of his journal when abroad, and all that happened. I dare not say anything of it. You will read for yourself and judge. And then when I see you, perhaps, you will be very kind and tell me what you think." "I promise," he said as I gave him the papers. "I shall in the morning, as soon as I can, come to see you and your husband, if I may." "Jonathan will be here at 11:30, and you must come to lunch with us and see him then. You could catch the quick 3:34 train, which will leave you at Paddington before 8. He was surprised at my knowledge of the trains off-hand, but he does not know that I have made up all the trains to and from Exeter, so that I may help Jonathan in case he is in a hurry. So he took the papers with him and went away, and I sit here thinking, thinking, I don't know what.
Letter by hand, Van Helsing to Miss Harker. September 25th, 6 o'clock. "Dear Madam Minna, I have read your husband's so wonderful diary. You may sleep without doubt. Strange and terrible as it is true. I will pledge my life on it. It may be worse for others, but for him and you there is no dread. He is a noble fellow, and let me tell you from experience of men, that one who would do as he did in going down that wall into that room, aye, and going down a second time, is not one to be injured in permanence by a shock. His brain and his heart are all right, this I swear, before I have even seen him, so be at rest. I shall have much to ask him of other things. I am blessed that today I come to see you, for I have learned all at once so much that again I am dazzled, dazzled more than ever, and I must think. Yours, the most faithful Abraham Van Helsing."
Letter, Mrs. Harker to Van Helsing.
25th September, 6:30 p.m. "My dear Dr. Van Helsing, a thousand thanks for your kind letter, which has taken a great weight off my mind. And yet if it be true, what terrible things there are in the world, and what an awful thing if that man, that monster, be really in London. Oh, I fear to think. I have this moment, whilst writing, had a wire from Jonathan, saying that he leaves by the 6:25 tonight from Launceston, and will be here at 10:18, so that I shall have no fear tonight. Will you, therefore, instead of lunching with us, please come to breakfast at 8 o'clock, if this be not too early for you? You can get away, if you are in a hurry, by the 10:30 train, which will bring you to Paddington by 2:35. Do not answer this, as I shall take it that, if I do not hear, you will come to breakfast. believe me, your faithful and grateful friend, Mina Harker.
Jonathan Harker's Journal.
Jonathan Harker's Journal, 26th of September. I never thought to write in this diary again, but the time has come. When I got home last night, Mina had supper ready, and when we had supped, she told me of Van Helsing's visit, and of her having given him the two diaries copied out, and of how anxious she had been about me. She showed me in the doctor's letter all that I wrote down was true. It seems to have made a new man of me. It was the doubt as to the reality of the whole thing that knocked me over. I felt impotent, and in the dark, and distrustful. But now that I know, I am not afraid, even of the Count. He has succeeded after all, then, in his design in getting to London, and it was he I saw. He has got younger, and how? Van Helsing is the man to unmask him and hunt him out, if he is anything like what Mina says. We sat late and talked it all over. Mina is dressing, and I shall call at the hotel in a few minutes and bring him over. He was, I think, surprised to see me. When I came into the room where he was and introduced myself, he took me by the shoulder and turned my face round to the light and said, after a sharp scrutiny, "But Madame Mina told me you were ill and that you had had a shock." It was so funny to hear my wife called Madame Mina by this kindly, strong-faced old man. I smiled and said, "I was ill. I have had a shock, but you have cured me already." "And how?" "By your letter to Mina last night." I was in doubt, and then everything took a hue of unreality, and I did not know what to trust, even the evidence of my own senses. Not knowing what to trust, I did not know what to do, and so had only to keep on working in what had hitherto been the groove of my life. The groove ceased to avail me, and I mistrusted myself. "Doctor, you don't know what it is to doubt everything, even yourself." "No, you don't. You couldn't with eyebrows like yours." He seemed pleased and laughed as he said, "So, you are a physiognomist. I learn more here with each hour. I am with so much pleasure coming to you to breakfast, and how, sir, you will pardon praise from an old man, but you are blessed in your wife." I would listen to him go on praising Mina for a day, so I simply nodded and stood silent. "She is one of God's women fashioned by his own hand to show us men and other women that there is a heaven where we can enter, and that its light can be here on earth. So true, so sweet, so noble, so little an egoist, and that, let me tell you, is much in this age, so sceptical and selfish. And you, sir, I have read all the letters to poor Miss Lucy, and some of them speak of you, and so I know you since some days from the knowing of others. But I have seen your true self since last night. You will give me your hand, will you not, and let us be friends for all our lives." We shook hands, and he was so earnest and so kind that it made me quite choky. "And now," he said, "may I ask you for some more help? I have a great task to do, and at the beginning it is to know. You can help me here. Can you tell me what went before your going to Transylvania? Later on I may ask more help and of a different kind, but at first this will do." "Look here, sir," I said, "does what you have to do concern the Count?" "It does," he said solemnly. "Then I am with you heart and soul. As you go by the 10:30 train, you will not have time to read them, but I shall get the bundle of papers. You can take them with you and read them in the train." After breakfast, I saw him to the station. When we were parting, he said, "Perhaps you will come to town if I send to you. And take Madame Mina, too." "We shall both come when you will," I said. I had got him the morning papers and the London papers of the previous night, and while we were talking at the carriage window, waiting for the train to start, he was turning them over. His eye suddenly seemed to catch something in one of them, the Westminster Gazette, I know it by the colour, and he grew quite white. He read something intently, groaning to himself, "Mein God, so soon, so soon!" I do not think he remembered me at the moment. Just then the whistle blew and the train moved off. This recalled him to himself, and he leaned out the window and waved his hand, calling out, "Love to Madame Mina! I shall write so soon as ever I can."
Dr. Seward's Diary, 26 September.
Truly, there is no such thing as finality. Not a week since I said fini, and yet here I am starting fresh again, or rather going on with the record. Until this afternoon, I had no cause to think of what is done. Renfield had become, to all intents, as sane as he ever was. He was already well ahead with his fly business, and he had just started in the spider line also, so he had not been of any trouble to me. I had a letter from Arthur, written on Sunday, and from it I gathered that he is bearing up wonderfully well. Quincy Morris is with him, and that is much of a help, for he himself is a bubbling well of good spirits. Quincy wrote me a line, too, and from him I hear that Arthur is beginning to recover something of his old buoyancy. So as to them, all my mind is at rest. As for myself, I am settling down to my work with the enthusiasm which I used to have for it, so that I might fairly have said that the wound which Lucy left on me was becoming cicatrized. Everything is, however, now reopened, and what is to be the end, God only knows. I have an idea that Van Helsing thinks he knows too, but he will only let out enough at a time to whet curiosity. He went to Exeter yesterday and stayed there all night. Today he came back, and almost bounded into the room about 5:30, and thrust last night's Westminster Gazette into my hand. "What do you think of that?" he asked, as he stood back and folded his arms. I looked over the paper, for I really did not know what he meant, but he took it from me and pointed out a paragraph about children being decoyed away at Hampstead. It did not convey much to me until I reached a passage where it described small puncture wounds on their throats. An idea struck me and I looked up. "Well," he said, "it is like poor Lucy's. And what do you make of it?" "Simply that there is some cause in common. Whatever it was that injured her has injured them." I did not quite understand his answer. "That is true indirectly, but not directly." "How do you mean, Professor?" I asked. I was a little inclined to take his seriousness lightly, for after all, 4 days of rest and freedom from burning, harrowing anxiety does help to restore one's spirits. But when I saw his face, it sobered me. Never, even in the midst of our despair about poor Lucy, had he looked more stern. "Tell me," I said. "I can hazard no opinion. I do not know what to think, and I have no data on which to found a conjecture. Do you mean to tell me, friend John, that you have no suspicion as to what poor Lucy died of, not after all the hints given not only by events but by me? Of nervous prostration following a great loss or waste of blood. And how was the blood lost or wasted?" I shook my head. He stepped over and sat down beside me and went on. "You are a clever man, friend John. You reason well, and your wit is bold, but you are too prejudiced. You do not let your eyes see nor your ears hear, and that which is outside your daily life is not of account to you. Do you not think that there are things which you cannot understand, and yet which are? That some people see things that others cannot, but there are things old and new which must not be contemplated by men's eyes, because they know, or think they know, something which other men have told them. Ah, it is the fault of our science that it wants to explain all, and if it explain not, then it says there is nothing to explain. But yet we see around us every day the growth of new beliefs, which think themselves new, and which are yet but the old, which pretend to be young, like the fine ladies at the opera. I suppose now you do not believe in corporal transference, no? Nor in materialization, no? Nor in astral bodies, no? Nor in the reading of thought, no? Nor in hypnosis? Yes, I said, Charcot has proved that pretty well. He smiled as he went on. Then you are satisfied as to it, yes? And of course then you understand how it act, and can follow the mind of the great Charcot, alas that he is no more, into the very soul of the patient that he influence, no? Then, friend John, am I to take it that you simply accept fact and are satisfied to let from premise to conclusion be a blank? No? Then tell me, for I am a student of the brain, how you accept hypnotism and reject thought reading. Let me tell you, my friend, that there are things done today in electrical science which would have been deemed unholy by the very men who discovered electricity, who would themselves not so long before been burned as wizards. There are always mysteries in life. Why was it that Methuselah lived 900 years and old Parr 169, and yet that poor Lucy, with four men's blood in her poor veins, could not live even one day. For had she lived one more day, we could have saved her. Do you know all the mysteries of life and death? Do you know the altogether of comparative anatomy and can say wherefore the qualities of brutes are in some men and not in others? Can you tell me why, when other spiders die small and soon, that one great spider lived for centuries in the tower of the old Spanish church and grew, till on descending he could drink the oil of all the church lamps? Can you tell me why in the Pampas, aye, and elsewhere, there are bats that come out at night and open the veins of cattle and horses and suck dry their veins? How in some islands of the western seas, there are bats which hang on the trees all day, and those who have seen describe as like giant nuts or pods, and that when the sailors sleep on the deck because that it is hot, flit down on them and then in the morning are found dead men, white as even Miss Lucy was? Good God, Professor, I said, starting up. Do you mean to tell me that Lucy was bitten by such a bat, and that such a thing is here in London in the 19th century? He waved his hand for silence and went on. Can you tell me why the tortoise live more long than generations of men? Why the elephant goes on and on till he have seized dynasties? And why the parrot never die only of bite of cat, of dog, or other complaint? Can you tell me why men believe in all ages and places that there are men and women who cannot die? We all know, because science has vouched for the fact, that there have been toads shut up in rocks for thousands of years, shut in one so small hole that only hold him since the youth of the world. Can you tell me how the Indian fakir can make himself to die and have been buried and his grave sealed and corn sowed on it and the corn reaped and be cut and sown and reaped and cut again? And then men come and take away the unbroken seal, and that there lie the Indian fakir, not dead, but rise up and walk among them as before. Here I interrupted him. I was getting bewildered. He so crowded on my mind his list of nature's eccentricities and possible impossibilities that my imagination was getting fired. I had a dim idea that he was teaching me some lesson, as long ago he used to do in his study at Amsterdam. But he used then to tell me the thing, so that I could have the object of thought in mind all the time. But now I was without his help, yet I wanted to follow him, so I said, "Professor, let me be your pet student again. Tell me the thesis, so that I may apply your knowledge as you go on. At present, I am going in my mind from point to point as a madman and not a sane one follows an idea. I feel like a novice lumbering through a bog in a mist, jumping from one tussock to another in the mere blind effort to move on without knowing where I'm going." "That is a good image," he said. "Well, I shall tell you. My thesis is this. I want you to believe." "To believe what?" "To believe in things that you cannot. Let me illustrate. I heard once of an American who so defined faith, that faculty which enables us to believe things which we know to be untrue. For one, I followed that man. He meant that we shall have an open mind and not let a little bit of truth check the rush of the big truth, like a small rock does a railway track. We get the small truth first. Good. We keep him and we value him. But all the same, we must not let him think himself all the truth in the universe." "Then you want me not to let some previous conviction injure the receptivity of my mind with regard to some strange matter. Do I read your lesson right?" "Ah, you are my favorite pupil still. It is worth to teach you. Now that you are willing to understand, you have taken the first step to understand. You think, then, that those so small holes in the children's throat were made by the same that made the holes in Miss Lucy?" "Well, I suppose so." He stood up and said solemnly, "Then you are wrong. Oh, would it were so. But alas, No, it is worse. Far, far worse. In God's name, Professor Van Helsing, what do you mean? I cried. He threw himself with a despairing gesture into a chair and placed his elbows on the table, covering his face with his hands as he spoke. They were made by Miss Lucy.
So I had a weird technical glitch. I had to move a lot of audio from before the chapters to after the chapters because I've listened to chapter 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, and 17 like 20 times over the last 2 or 3 weeks. And I'd, even with all of my notes, I had forgotten that Van Helsing doesn't say that Lucy is the Bloofer Lady until the end of this chapter. I thought it was after the Westminster Gazette, which, by the way, the paper, the Westminster Gazette, real paper, the newsprint was green. That's why Jonathan Harker says, I knew it by its color. Isn't that cool? So the audio that follows was originally supposed to be before this chapter, and as a consequence, there are things that I will say like, Mina will say such and such, and you've just heard it. So forgive me for that. I just wove that blasted Bloofer Lady stuff all the way throughout this part of the conversation, and so I had to move it. I really didn't want to re-record it again. I'd already lost too much audio. So forgive me. I know it means you had to wait until now for the title of the podcast. Sometimes a cigar is just to make any sense, because now we are going to be talking about, yes, you guessed it, sex. Because it's going to rear its ugly head. And certainly any literary criticism that you read written about Dracula that's been, you know, written in the last 45 or 50 years, you're going to read about how this is all the pesky patriarchy wrestling with how the evils of a sexualized woman or whatever. And I really, you know, I feel like I'm walking a very cautious line. I really understand why some people read it that way and enjoy reading it that way and are very satisfied reading it that way. And that's fine. But I like to try and put myself into Bram Stoker's mindset and an author's mindset when writing a story. And of course, he's setting out to write just a really good suspense novel. I've never met an author, and I've never heard of an author who is any good, who sits down and says, you know, I think I want to write a sexual allegory about how women should really just wear a chastity belt. You know, I don't think anyone sets out to do that. I think sometimes with some authors, it becomes clear after a while that something that was bugging them is coming out in the book, and they realize that they have written a book with intense symbolism and things like that. And that's just because they're a really good writer, not because Nathaniel Hawthorne sat down and said, I am going to write a book that begins with a symbol of a rose, and that rose is going to symbolize, you know, I mean, I just think most writers want to tell a good story. So if we work from that as our first principle, then it makes perfect sense that the unconscious mind of Bram Stoker would be wrestling with sexual politics of the day, which were very prominent. Women were agitating for the vote. All you have to do is read Oscar Wilde or Shaw or any of these people to see that while Victoria was a woman and in charge, and no one questioned that, outside of her leadership, which, you know, and she already had the prime minister there, so she was not Queen Elizabeth I running the country. So even though you undisputably have a very strong woman on the throne and at least nominally in charge, you have some men working very hard to convince themselves and everyone else that women are still very weak and meek and mild and pure and all of that, with plenty of proof to the contrary. However, there is no question that this was kind of an existential wrestling match that was happening in the society of the time. So it makes perfect sense that when Stoker has to write a woman who winds up getting seduced, I think we have to use the word, by Dracula, and eventually loses her life through his machinations and becomes immortal and a horrifying, you know, killer of, well, she hasn't killed anybody yet. She's still just harming people, but it's still really creepy. And I think that it doesn't surprise me a bit that if there's this other fearful thing going on the side, oh, women are getting power, and you know, clearly we have been a force to be reckoned with. When we've gotten a hold of power, we have done stuff, and it might be kind of scary for the guys who were in charge at the time, who had had such a tight lid on it for so long. You know, the thought of changing that very basic paradigm would have been really creepy. And I mean, you can look at history going back thousands of years, and you can see that the Industrial Revolution is really responsible for a lot of this, because it really stratified men's and women's jobs. When you're dealing with an agrarian society, everybody's kind of working together on the farm, and the men's and women's work starts to overlap because the women wind up having to help out with the harvest and all of that. Anyway, all I'm saying is it's not a surprise that sexuality gets thrown into the mix when you're having a male writer who has kind of a difficult marriage. I don't want to go so far as to say loveless, but why don't I say loveless marriage? He wasn't so happy. Clearly adored his mom, who told him all the scary stories in the first place. And so it just doesn't surprise me that the sexual undertones are there. But my husband and I were talking last night, and he brought up something that I think is important and probably closer to the truth than Bram Stoker was sitting down to write a subversive anti-woman book or anything like that. Stoker's Irish, and we can't forget that. Even though he's living in England, and he walks like an Englishman, and he talks like an Englishman, and he dresses like an Englishman, he's still Irish. And as with any outsider, and I'm putting that in air quotes, anyone who is an outsider in a society, whether it's women in the society of men, or whether it's Irish in the society of the UK, or whether it's German immigrants in the society of the early 1900s in the United States, you know, whatever outsider it is that you're talking about, the outsider always knows more about the power holders than the power holders know about them. This is exactly why, when I taught high school in New York City, I learned a whole lot about white folks that had never occurred to me before, because I hadn't been privileged to hear what the outsiders, in this case, my Hispanic and African-American students and Asian students in New York City, what they saw from the quote-unquote outside about white folks. And dead on accurate, hello. Oh my goodness, it was a great education. It was also the first opportunity that I had to really see how this kind of outsider, insider power play could work in literature. So you've got Stoker, an Irishman, who is at least stereotyped as an Irishman as being a bit more sexual than the uber repressed British men. I'm just going to put that out there without comment for a second, because there's more there. He's writing a story about very, very British people in the middle. You've got Lord Godalming, you've got Arthur, you've got Lucy, you've got Mina, you've got Jonathan. That's our British center. You've got Van Helsing coming in from Holland. This crazy German-speaking, because he does, I mean, mein Gott, you know, he's kind of a mixed-up Dutchman. He's not exactly written Dutch. And all of the literary criticism comments on this at some point. They're like, yeah, this isn't actually how, not so much Dutch. But you've got Van Helsing, who's an outsider and who is more accepting of, more in tune with, and more able to see the particular branch of reality that these people are suddenly dealing with. And that would be the supernatural reality. So you've got
Stoker commenting on the ultra-rational, British, kind of uptight, a superstructure of British society from kind of upper middle class, Jonathan and Mina, and upper class, Godalming and Lucy. And you've got Van Helsing coming in from the outside, who's just wicked crazy. And you'll hear him say crazier and crazier things as we go on. And then you've got Dracula, you know, far in the east, in the, who was it? Edward Said, who wrote the Orientalism book. Oh God, I can't remember the name of it. But one of the things that he commented on is how if Western society, Americans, Europeans, think of the East or the Far East, the only way that it can be acceptable is if you somehow turn it into kind of a seductive, attractive other, you know, a geisha. This is the only acceptable vision for Western iconography or for Western art or for Western minds to be able to handle. Because if you allow them to be more fully human, then suddenly they're real, and some people would think a threat, and that would be very scary. And so people just kind of infantilize or turn people who are different from them into children, just like you see happening with women. So it is very possible that at least some of what you read or listen to about Mina and Jonathan and their relationship, and Lucy and how she has turned, some of this may have been Stoker sticking it to the Brits. I haven't read that anywhere, but as soon as my husband said that, I thought, oh my gosh, you know, that's just as likely as anything else. And that actually, I think, makes a lot more sense than him sitting down and saying, I'm going to write about how we need to repress our women, because that just doesn't strike me as Stoker. He does seem to have a wicked sense of humor, and this would be a very fun, almost tongue-in-cheek thing for him to have done. So all of that is fun and nifty, but one other thing that we need to remember is, as far as the story goes, we now have Van Helsing convinced that Lucy has become the Bloofer Lady, which is kind of creepy. And that means that Stoker has taken this image of a young woman, an attractive woman, a good woman, a pure woman, a chaste woman, all that stuff, and has taken the archetypal mother figure and has totally perverted it in the actions of, we're assuming, Lucy, that she is not nurturing children. She is actually sucking their blood. Now, she's not killing them. So, you know, one point to Lucy, but that is supposed to be disturbing. And in this chapter, you will actually, it flies by, but you will hear Mina talk about this, about maternal instincts in women. You'll hear it in this chapter, and just let that ring a bell, because Lucy, instead of giving and sacrificing for children, you know, it doesn't matter if you eat dinner, they need to eat dinner. The perversion of that into someone who's taking the blood out of the children and leaving them alive, but sickly and weak. And as you'll hear from Van Helsing over the next couple of chapters, at great risk, it's a creepy perversion. And probably, I admit it, it's probably creepier because it's a young girl who we grew to like. I mean, she might've been silly and all of that, but she was certainly sweet. Nothing wrong with Lucy. I think she was more interesting as a character than Lucy Manette in Tale of Two Cities. So this is the maternal thing is creepy. And I think, again, if Stoker was out to unnerve us and create a lot of suspense, but really truly unnerve us, you know, any time you get unnerved or uncomfortable like that, it's because there's some kind of cognitive dissonance happening where two things do not match up. And this is one of those places where you like Lucy, but now she's feeding on children. And that's not what women do. That's it goes way beyond wrong. That's just sick. So now the only woman we have left for us, really, is Mina. And of course, she's married, which already makes her safe. And yet she still appears to be chaste and virtuous, you know, within her marriage, and Jonathan adores her, and everyone adores her, and everyone's going to continue to adore her. And Mina is going to continue to become a more and more interesting character. In our chapters today, she does some stuff that you will, if not laugh at, you will smile at, because she doesn't read like Lucy Manette. You know, she is an interesting person who is quirky, and you haven't had a chance to see a lot of that yet, but you will today. And it's, you know, just a little thing. There's subtle stuff, but it all starts to add up. But it is interesting that even within the confines of marriage, Mina isn't really allowed to be a sexual being either. At the same time, what cause would there be to discuss it? It's not like Bram Stoker is writing a Danielle Steele novel and going into the bedroom with Jonathan and fading to black. You know, it's not that kind of book. But one would think, I mean, a healthy sexual relationship is part of a marriage, an adult relationship. I mean, whether you're a woman married to a woman or a man married to a man or a woman married to a man, if you are in a loving, committed relationship and you're an adult, sexuality should probably be involved. And I mean, you know, go back to the Bible. Anybody who's actually taken the time to read the Song of Solomon, yowza. We actually sang that in our high school choir. I kid you not. It was a 42-page piece of music, and they had edited it, but we did all wind up going home and reading, you know, an entire book of the Bible just to see what the Song of Solomon thing was about. And I think we were all, you know, at the ripe old age of 17, pretty surprised. So I think it is undeniable that sexuality starts to play a larger and larger role in the book. I also think that with Lucy, where Stoker was headed was the perversion of motherhood, much more than Lucy all of a sudden wants to kiss Arthur. Now, they way over-sexualized her in the Winona Ryder version, and I was really upset by what they did to Lucy. And by anyone's standards, I mean, even the Age of Innocence standards, asking your fiancé to kiss you is not a crime. It's kind of weird to do it in front of other people, but I think Stoker was really going towards the maternal thing. And that is where we will end for today. Next week and the week after, I am doing straight chapters and chapter talk, because I will be recording those episodes tomorrow. And so today, I am wishing you all the happiest of holidays, whatever your holidays may be. I hope they are filled with joy and warmth and laughter and good times. And if those things can be procured with your family around you, then I hope your family is there. Take care. I will be having a wonderful time too, and have a happy, happy new year. I'll see you in 2012. Please remember to support the people who support Craftlit. Visit Knit Circus online magazine, offering 3 rings of knitting, sewing, and fun. You can check out the latest issue at www.knitcircus.com. And what would Madame Defarge knit? A new book of knit and crochet patterns coming to you from the Craftlit family. And please visit the blogs and sites of Craftlit supporters. Those links can be found in the sidebar of the show notes. The show notes can be found at craftlit.com. Craftlit can also be accessed by its own Android and iPhone application. You can purchase it at the iPhone or iTouch application store, or you can subscribe free at iTunes. Craftlit is made possible by the generous support of its listeners, and for that, I am truly grateful. And remember, if your hands are too busy to pick up a book, at least you can turn one.